Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on Tour.com. Joining me today is Daniel Jose Older, who is a writer, editor, columnist, musician. He's been a paramedic too. His Bond Street Rumba series of novels began with last year's Half Resurrection Blues. He's working on a graphic novel series. And when he's not writing for places like Tor.com or BuzzFeed or Strange Horizons, amongst others, he is, nowadays talking about his fantastic new young adult urban fantasy, Shadow Shaper. Daniel, welcome to Midnight in Karachi. I'm so pleased to be talking to you tonight.
Thank you so much, and I'm so happy to be here.
Now, as much as I very recently enjoyed Shadow Shaper, and I do want to talk about it and about your other work, I have to ask first, because I'm intrigued by this idea of the time you spent working as a paramedic. I can only imagine how the things you experienced in that sort of very high-stress, complicated job, you know, did they play into your fiction? Do they do that now? What was it like?
Absolutely. And I think what always sort of strikes me about it is that the high stress parts were really not the parts that people always expect them to be. And by which I mean, like, you know, the life and death stuff is not exactly the highest stress part. It's really the bureaucracy and the boredom and the BS and all that other stuff that's like really has you, you know, managing a system that's not really about humanity, but it's a business. And when you're actually in the thick of things and you have someone's life in your hands, that's like what you're there to do, you know, and there's this intense kind of, I think, cleansing that happens from being in such a purpose-driven situation and being so focused on that. And that I always found to be very almost soothing, even in, you know, in the midst of tragedy, like you're taking part in it. And I think it can have a very healing effect in some ways, both for the patient and for the person taking care of the patient. So, healing is a strange thing. It's weird, and it happens in ways that we don't always expect it. But the hardest parts were when, not so much when things didn't go the way we wanted them to, so much as when there was literally just nothing to be done. Or, you know, something would happen far away. I think it's that helplessness that really causes trauma the most. So all of those different angles of being in the midst of life and death and taking part in the world and dealing with bureaucracy, that is all like really the foundation of, you know, the fiction that I write.
Were you writing at the same time as having this as a day job?
Literally in the stretcher. I would just jump into back on slow nights and get some chapters written.
That's amazing. It couldn't have been easy. I'm wondering how that focus developed.
In a way, it was. I mean, it would depend because there's slow units and there's more busy units. So if I knew there was one I used to work that it was literally a midnight shift. It started at midnight and it went through to noon the next day, and it was in a very quiet section of the Bronx. And we would just sit in a park all night, and you know, we could pretty much guarantee at least a couple hours of not having to do anything. So I would take advantage. And then other times I just wouldn't bother, and because, you know, I'd know that it was gonna be a busy night, and so I would just work, and then because they're 12-hour shifts, it would be 3 days a week. It was like full time, so I would have 4 days off a week, and that's when I would really get the writing in.
So now the new novel is Shadow Shaper, which is out, well, when this runs, it'll have been out a couple of days. This was apparently the first book you sat down to write, though, of course, it's not the first book you've published. How did that happen, and did the book go through many evolutions, as it were, before publication?
It did. For one thing, publishing is slow, and I think children's publishing is notoriously even slower, from what I understand. So it just took a long time to go through the, you know, the machinery of getting to this day. That happened. And then I wrote the book, you know, of course, without an agent or anybody else, I wrote the first draft and I just started sending it out. And Scholastic, specifically Arthur A. Levine, which is the imprint it comes out of, they didn't require agents. So basically I sent it to them and they were interested in it, but that took a long, long time to figure out, because you know how it is. Like, you send two or three chapters, and then they want to see maybe 90 pages, and then, but that's all over the course of months and months and months, and then years. And it's like, whoo! So in the meantime, I started writing short stories for adults, which is what turned into Salsa Nocturna, and that's actually my first book. It's a collection of short stories. So that came out, and that's the same world that Half Resurrection is. It all just basically came out of that. So everything kind of happened. Like, I feel like my career happened in the meantime while I was getting Shadow Shaper together and going through the process and edits. And yes, it has been very, that book more than anything else I've worked on has been so many different books. Like I've torn it down to the barest of bones and then rebuilt the whole thing. It's been like sprawled across my office wall in the form of little cartoons and cutouts for years at a time, you know, while I would pick up pieces and move them over here and there. It's been an amazing process. And that's unusual for me. I tend to be someone that sits down and just writes and gets more or less what I want to get, you know, as far as like structure early on in like the early draft form. But this book was like, woo! But, you know, I learned so much in the process. And Cheryl Klein, my editor, was amazing to work with and to learn from, and different people that helped me along the way. Nathan Bransford was working with a little bit at the beginning, and just people have really just been, I have learned so much writing this book.
I have to know, when did you know that it was done?
Today. I don't know the answer to that. That's a great question. You know, there have been so many stages of done, because there's the done before you send it, and then there's the done when you start getting edits, and then there's another done. I don't know if I remember. I remember coming up to that moment and in my head being like, when I finish this draft, this is going to be the last draft. Like, and it's almost intimidating, because I got so used to, over the years that I've been working on the book, I got so used to it being an impermanent thing, because I kept making changes. And as much as that was kind of annoying to like never feel like it was quite done, there's also sort of a freedom in it, in that, well, I'm gonna change this, send it in, see what the editor thinks, get it back, whatever. It's all very fluid. And then at a certain point, it's not fluid anymore. And those decisions are the decisions. And that is another level of kind of intense, which kind of relates back to being a medic, because being a medic is really more than anything else about making those decisions. And, you know, it's the kind of thing you can't really learn when you're like shadowing somebody on a rotation. Like, you know, there's skills, and then there's knowing your protocols and this and that and the other. But ultimately, when you're in the street, like working on a patient, which doesn't, you know, usually go the way the textbooks go, those decisions that you make are the ones that matter. And that's what makes you a medic. So that really related to those last couple rounds of edits and that final edit, when you're just like, okay, this is the word I want. This is the, you know, this is the direction of the story. This is the rhythm. All those things really come into play, and then they become fixed. And it's like, whoo, it's pretty deep.
So throughout the various versions, was Sierra always the protagonist, the young woman who the story is about? Because she's fantastic. And I want to know how you got to know her this way, or you got to create her this way, and if she genuinely was the sort of the anchor for all the different drafts.
Absolutely the anchor. She was the first thing that happened in the book. And she came to me fully formed. Her personality has always been exactly what it is, even as the mythology and the world around her changed a lot. The one major change for Sierra that I think was really a turning point was that she wasn't always a painter. First, she was like, you know, a skateboard kid, basically. Her main thing was that she wanted to skateboard all around the city and just have a good time or whatever, which was cool. And I think that worked in its own right for the draft that it was. But as the in the original version, there's a lot of other kind of monsters and worlds and mythologies that happen. And the Painted Dead was one of them. And the Painted Dead basically being, you know, murals that come to life with spirits. And then at some point that became the whole book, and that kind of took over. So when that happened, I wanted her to be able to step up to the plate and kind of have something to match and to fit in with that mythology of paintings coming to life. And also, I was the drawing kid when I was a kid. That was who I was. I loved drawing all the time. I always had, like, you know, a paper and a pad and pen. And so I kind of gave her that part of me, I feel like. And that's when she came to life on another level, because she really became a much more active, I think, protagonist at that moment. And I could just relate to her on another level, because here was this character that, you know, had a sort of escape and a sort of a way to express herself that no one else necessarily understood. And, you know, all those things, that was really a turning point for me with her.
I really like the idea of the city, the urban landscape as a character in itself, and sort of it's integral to the story's narrative. In Shadow Shaper, I think that's very much what happens. You know, the murals on the wall come to life, shadows come to life, things hiding between the buildings and the streets, the art and the architecture, everything's very alive and full of character. You're obviously really familiar with the spaces that you've written about here. Did you grow up in these areas? What did you do to know them and to use them to your advantage in your work?
I didn't grow up here. I grew up in Boston. I've been here for 12 years now, and it's really a matter of feeling that the streets speak very loudly when I walk down them, and listening and paying attention to what they're saying, whether it's gossip on the corner or the subtleties of, you know, what different materials are used or what signs are up or what buildings are closed or open. I feel like it's those details that bring a world to life, and, you know, the rhythms both in speech pattern and just in the general flow of things. And it's all these sort of things that we don't quite, you know, you really can't quantify any of those things. It's just that energy, and it gets captured and transmitted through the way that Sierra, I think, exists in her world, and also how she relates to it on an emotional plane. Because I say a lot, like, you know, a lot of the issues that kind of get brought up, like whether it's gentrification or street harassment, you know, it's very easy to get heady about a lot of that stuff. But ultimately, those are things that people, especially people who go through them, deal with and confront emotionally. So I think having the characters have an emotional relationship to the place that they live in, and that place that they live in, I think a big part of it is also being really honest about the conflict that happens there. So, you know, there is a lot of conflict, there's a lot of crisis in Brooklyn, and there's a lot of beauty, and there's a lot of community and a lot of love. And so it's like it really a question of telling the truth. And so, you know, painting that picture as fully as I can and not letting it intrude on the plot, but letting it more be in conversation, I think, with the plot.
I was going to actually bring up the gentrification, the street harassment, things like that that you just mentioned. It's interesting because that's what makes the book very atmospheric. And I mean, I've been to New York once or twice in my life. I obviously don't know this area very well. And yet, what made me feel connected to that sort of urban landscape was not a description of what the lay of the land was, but was, you know, how the characters felt towards their environment, which I think is what makes it work. Yeah. What makes it tick.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly what I go for. And I think that, strategically speaking, I think context is a very useful tool for us as artists when we want to think more deeply about politics and bring in like a nuanced understanding of power in the world. Context is really the place for that. I find that when we do it with context, it kind of allows us to not have to do that so much with the narrative itself. And then the narrative will speak to that more naturally because the world around the story is, you know, telling these more difficult truths. So within that story, you know, there can be a counterpoint between the story and the world, you know, in the sense that, like, right, Sierra's fighting patriarchy, right? You know, she's dealing with the fact that her family didn't entrust her with secrets because she's a girl, and she's dealing with the fact that a white outsider, you know, wants to take over what she, you know, is part of her tradition and her family. So those are these underlying conflicts. And I think when, you know, like for me, it was a question of then drawing the world around her, and again, in an honest way, but also in a way that would have some kind of counterpoint and be in dialogue with those deeper conflicts. So, you know, there's a connection between her getting harassed when she walks down the street and her family's deep-seated sense that, you know, men are more important. And like that, those things are all connected, just the way that oppression is connected throughout the world, right? So on a literary level, I think it kind of allows a lot of room to talk about that stuff, but not bog down the plot with like trying to be preachy about it.
I don't want to scare anyone away from reading the book, but it's a really smart book.
Thank you.
You know, given that it has this like it has this really like fast plot and like lots of stuff is happening all the time, but all these layers do work into it. And the more I talk to you about it, the more evident it becomes in my mind. I'm not trying to scare anyone away by saying it's smart. It's also lots of fun. So, you know, if that's what you're looking for. I often find that cultures with a sort of deep sense of spirituality, also of superstition, of sort of ancient ancestral rites and beliefs, sort of often lend themselves, cultures like this, lend themselves really well to science fiction and fantasy. You've obviously used elements of Afro-Caribbean spirituality in your work. I imagine to some extent that just feels natural to you.
I think there's a lot of interesting conversations to be had about ancestry, and we're not having them in the mainstream horror and fantasy world. You know, like, ghosts are still generally in the U.S. a negative thing, and that's like across the board. You know, like, ghosts fall into the realm of horror movies and where they show up and scare people, and, you know, the Indian burial ground bullshit that white rights tend to do, all this, you know, crap. Like, I think that's just a missed opportunity. I think every other culture basically in the world has a much more complicated relationship to, you know, the people that came before us and our lineage and our ancestry than either glamorizing them with statues, you know, which are lies, or making them into monsters. There's so much in between that. And for me, the tradition that I'm a part of, the Lukumi tradition, is very much about being in dialogue and in conversation with spirit. I don't think prayer is a one-way street. So I try to bring that to the fiction. I think that that's a really interesting way to approach ghosts. I think, you know, ghosts bring so much possibility for exploring history and exploring the crossroads of the past and the present and exploring humanity. And I really feel like ghost stories are so much about life and being alive and not that much about death. And that was my takeaway from writing this book, really, and from writing the Bone Street Roomba, is that there is so much life in the dead, you know, and in the memories and in the way that we carry the dead with us, not always in a bad way. That was a very joyful kind of moment to understand that in the process, because Sierra takes a lot of strength ultimately from her ancestors and from the spirits that look out for her, even as she's fighting other spirits. And that's just something I want to see more of. You know, it's out there for sure. There's examples. I love it in Harry Potter in the final book when that happens. I would still say that just across the board in general, you know, the U.S. in particular, and I would say white culture specifically, is not so good at getting into more complex understandings of ancestry.
Now, music was, of course, also a large part of this book. I imagine it's a large part of your life. The language is very rhythmic, but there's also an actual musician who's caught up in the shadow shaping as well, Sierra's brother. You're a musician too. What sort of music do you, you know, play, and how does it factor into your work?
I do a lot of different stuff. I was doing a lot of composing for choreographers and puppeteers and independent filmmakers before I started writing novels. So I was doing a lot of collaborative projects, and then I have a band that plays out now and again. And I really just love writing music. I love playing music. I'm not a professional musician in the sense that I could never, like, you know, just go into a studio and sight read for somebody's project. But I love the process of creating music, whether it's improvised or composed. And I find that for me, like, on to come back again on a strategic level, like, when I approach the written word, I do try to think about songs that I love, or even more specifically, like, moments in songs that I love, and kind of reach for that elegance or chaos. And I always do it knowing in a very humble way that I will never get there. You know, like, there's no way that prose can do what Miles' trumpet can do, or what, you know, Radiohead can. But I think that in the effort to get there, we do something new and different, and that is its own kind of glory. And so I'm happy to fail, because I think you find something new by trying, and I love that idea, and I love just music. And I also plot a lot to music. You know, I think we kind of fall under this idea that, like, you're only working on the book when you're sitting in front of the computer, but we all know that you're really writing when you're on the train, going to work, and in the shower, and whatever. You know, all these different moments when you realize stuff. So I'll be commuting to wherever it is I'm teaching that day or whatever, and I'll have my headphones in, and I'll kind of create, like, playlists, which I think of as, like, soundtracks for whatever season it is or whatever time of my life it is, and those songs will ultimately become the soundtrack to whatever book or project I'm working on.
Is Miles's trumpet an ideal rhythm or sound that you would like to reach in your writing?
That's just one. It's very guided by what the book itself is trying to do. So I surely love that trumpet sound, but I also would say there are so many moments in rock and hip hop and jazz and lots of different, there's so many different Cuban styles of music that I love, cha-cha-cha, mambo, and so on, that really, it'll just be like this moment that'll jump out of a song, or sometimes a whole song, you know. Like most recently, I was listening to, there's this moment in All Along the Watchtower, the Jimi Hendrix version, where he's just going, like, he's just going to town, and the guitar notes are so urgent, and it's like he's just, it's like it feels like visually it's like he's spitting them out or like machine gunning them out, and like they can't wait to get out into the world, and they're tripping over each other, and it's so powerful. And I think a lot about, like, you know, urgency. I think urgency is a really deep and not that well understood concept in writing, both in fiction and in nonfiction. And it matters so much. Like, I think a lot of my favorite writers are my favorite writers because they tap into that sense of urgency that is like the now, you know, that is what's going on right now. And I don't know what that means or why. I don't know what it is exactly. And I like that I don't know. You know, I think there's a power in not being able to describe things because they're that gigantic or beyond, you know, words. So that, you know, which really comes back to that music piece. It's like, I know that, like, no one's ever going to write the prose that is exactly, you know, that matches those notes. But I think in the effort, you know, we find something, and it's like, oh, you know, there's a new language to be found there.
Now, we're talking about music, we've been talking about writing. I have to bring in the concept of art. The cover of Shadow Shaper, and in fact of your next book, Midnight Taxi Tango, I've admired it before, I know, on Twitter. But I have to bring it up again because it's incredible in just so many ways. I mean, Shadow Shaper, let's stick to Shadow Shaper for a second. Fine, you know, because more people will have seen that than perhaps the cover of Midnight Taxi Tango, which isn't out for a while. But Shadow Shaper, fine. It's a great looking cover. Fantastic colors. I love it. She's beautiful. But of course, it's more important than just, hey, yeah, nice looking. I mean, it's prominently features a young woman of color, natural hair in all its glory, yes, which is not something we see often, yes, even now. Even, in fact, I think that my first comparison was The Last Toni Morrison, which has, I mean, the cover that I had has this gorgeous sort of stark image of a very dark-skinned black woman. But she didn't have her natural hair, and it kind of threw me off even then. You know, she's meant to be this beautiful woman. Right. She's meant to be very dark-skinned. And, you know, they don't even usually put people like that on Toni Morrison novels, even though she could sell anything without a cover.
But even
that woman didn't have natural hair, but Sierra does. So very often, I find books, even books with a racially diverse cast, will still avoid putting them on the cover. So I have to ask, was this something you had specifically asked for?
Yes. And I want to say, too, though, that they were very open to it, and I didn't get pushback. They were like, yes, let's do this. I also wrote it in very clearly into the book for the purpose, partially, of being able to say, this is exactly who the character is, so don't tell me that it's not. You know, to be strategic about these things because... And that's not because of Scholastic, that's because of how publishing is, period.
Right.
You know,
though I find that
I wanted to have references.
Yeah, well, even with those references, even when a character is very clearly of a darker skin or a different, you know, ethnicity or whatever it is, I find sometimes they just don't put the character on the cover. That's like that kind of sidestep, you know? But that didn't happen here, of course.
Yes. Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think that they don't, I think that legitimately they don't want to be those people that do that. And I think that because we have been having these conversations now on a much louder and increasingly prominent platform, people are aware of them in new ways. So, like, you know, I think there is a certain amount of ignorance that happens. And I don't say that to give people a pass in the publishing industry, because I think, you know, most ignorance is willful, especially when it comes to understanding, you know, other races. But I think people also, like, really didn't know, and that those things matter. Some people definitely are strategic or think they're being strategic about using more Eurocentric features to market, which is a very damaging and dangerous kind of way to approach marketing. But I would say that because of the conversations that are being had on Twitter and other social network platforms, I mean, publishers are paying attention to those conversations. And I don't want to speculate as to where anyone's intentions are. I do think that genuinely Scholastic wanted to make a very strong statement, you know, with this book, and we're very clear about that. And and they consulted me a lot on the cover, which I really appreciated. And I was very clear about making sure that Sierra had big hair, you know, and was clearly not white, because that's a huge part of the book. But you're right, like that can be a huge part of the book, and they can still find a way to lightwash her and make her more Euro looking. All these different things that definitely happen. I also think that to a certain extent, the publishing industry in general doesn't want the beef that could be brought, and they've seen be brought, you know, by Twitter and by like the social movements that are going on. And so they're like, let's not have that problem. And sometimes the solution is not to put someone on the cover at all, which is, you know, kind of a sneaky way around it. But ultimately, I think there's been more excitement about the cover of the book, Shadow Shaper, than the actual book. You know what I mean? Like, right. People are so excited about this cover. People who I've never met or heard of and have never heard of me are showing up at my mentions just to tell me how beautiful this cover is. And I hope that, and I know really that publishers are paying attention to that fact, because it really does matter. And people are very, very willing to buy a cover with a beautiful black girl on the front with natural hair. Yeah. And they will see.
Because you're not just going to have a black audience buying it. You're going to have people like me who, you know, I'm in between. I never see people my color on books. My 7-year-old kid never sees people of her color in books. So this is the kind of thing that you have people of, I think, every race, everyone who's not white will look to, simply because, well, look, I guess there's an element of this is one of us.
People are fed up. I'll put it that way. People are fed up of the same old white people saving the world narrative. It's a lie. It's, you know, it's an ongoing cliche. It's boring. Like, we're bored by that. So I think that there's another element to just people, and not just people of color, but white people too, are just like, whoa, something different, you know, a different story. And I think that there's a lot of power in that. There's a lot of power in counter narratives. There's a lot of power in telling stories about people of color that are not just tragedies, you know, and that are not just about the past. Because you'll find often, especially I think in YA, that stories about racism tend to be relegated to like either slavery time or the civil rights era, as if it ended then. That's a much more comfortable way for white people to contemplate race in America, you know, something of the past. So that's one thing I'm really excited about with Shadow Shaper, is that it talks about race. It talks about race in like a number of different complex ways, from microaggressions to institutional power. And it talks about it in a very contemporary setting. And when I was writing an early draft of this, I had people from the publishing industry, nobody that I'm working with right now, but cross out entire sections and say, oh, that doesn't happen, you know, in this day and age. Like, what? You know, that moment right there to me summarizes what's wrong with having a 90% white publishing industry, is you get feedback, like really bullshit feedback like that. And then, you know, how do you push back against that? I mean, I did, but like, that's you know, it's so complicated. It's just such a mess.
It is. It's a big question. And I mean, I know it's difficult to sort of, we could talk about it endlessly, but I know you've been a big promoter of diversity in fiction, all sorts, not just racial diversity. But you've been a big promoter of this, as you said, through places like, or mediums like Twitter, etc. Though, of course, it's not as simple as just having a random brown kid or a random Asian kid or a random black kid in your book. It's not that simple. I'm often asking myself where the line between diversity and tokenism lies.
Yeah, that's such a great question. So hard to know. Because sometimes it's really like a gut feeling. Like there's sometimes when you're just like, you know, but it matters so much. So it's not something we can just sort of cast aside as like, well, I hope we get it right. You know, like, but I think that when you, it's also sort of the balance of, we don't want every book about a person of color to be a quote unquote issue book, but we also don't want books about people of color to pretend that everything is just one big, happy, cool world where there's nothing wrong. You know what I mean? Like, people of color experience racism on a daily basis. So like, as much as we can't have every book be a quote unquote issue book, we also can't ignore that there are realities to being a person of color that are different than being white people. And those matter. And those are, you know, if we're to be honest, those happen, you know, even when we're dealing with non-issue things. You know what I mean? So like, I guess that's part of why it was important to write this book and for it to be a fantasy, but also, you know, there's this moment when she's in Flatbush and she's trapped and she's being chased by a demon phantom and no one helps her. And people are ready to call the police on her. You know, and like, it's not even about making a political statement. That's just being honest. Like, there are places in Brooklyn where people of color are not safe, whether it's from phantoms or from racism. And that's something that YA needs to deal with. You know, that's like a reality. And it shouldn't just take an issue book to deal with that. That's just true whoever you are, you know. So I think, that's a tough balance. And I think that really what probably what it comes down to for me is like, are you dealing with power? Are you thinking in intelligent ways about how power functions for different people? And can you do it in a way that's not that doesn't necessarily wrap the whole book around that one thing, but is simply being honest about where people are at, and as we move through the world, what's our relationship to police, to power, to figures of authority, to the education system that wasn't built for us. You know what I mean? Like, those are ways that, like, those are all things that people deal with in YA, and they're gonna be dealt with differently based on what race the character is. And so I think it's about being honest, and it's about challenging ourselves to get deep and be uncomfortable.
That's a good answer.
Thank you.
Now, I read this older interview with you recently, in which you said success meant having people, and I'm paraphrasing, success meant having people recognize themselves in your work, and then that you were, you felt successful if you were able to inspire people to write their own stories and to see themselves in those stories. I couldn't agree more. I think that's sort of the most long-lasting impact a writer can have. It's much more long-lasting than any awards or any like gazillion-dollar advances if you can do that for a generation or five people even. I mean, do you think more writers
Yes.
who have some reach should be aiming for the same thing?
I don't know. It's really I the one thing I the I think the one true thing about success is that it's a very individual question, and that I really think each writer needs to determine it for themselves. So I just say that for me. I know that I entered into this journey with the intent of making change and of, causing problems for people in power and bringing up other people that aren't in power and making them comfortable. So that was strategic, and always, always, always to tell great stories. That kind of goes without saying because it's writing, but you need to say it. But that was part of what I went into it to do. I was an organizer before I was a writer, and so there's a lot of strategy in how I move and what I believe. And I think the number one thing behind that is like healing. It's always healing. It's all and inspiration is a form of healing. Yeah, there's so many cycles with that. But I guess I would say that with Salsa Nocturna, people were already emailing me that book made them feel like they could tell their story. And when I was getting those emails, I kind of felt like, well, shit, like this is what I came here to do. And if I can do it with one book coming out from a very small independent publishing house, which is amazing, by the way, I want to shout out Cross Genres because they do great work. If I can do that with my first book, like that's mission accomplished. You know what I mean? Like I did what I came here to do. I just want to keep doing that and do it more. So yeah, like when I get for me, when I get those emails, I just feel like, this is why I came here. And I know that, and I know that in my heart. And yeah, there's times when I get distracted, and there's times when I get caught up in the game of like recognition and which review and stars and awards and this stuff. And then I always really, really, really have to remind myself and end up reminding myself to come back to those emails and those tweets and those messages that I get from people who just say like, yes, like I needed to see this. I needed to see myself on a cover. I needed to see, myself and all of my messy truth in the page and know that I could be a protagonist. And, whether it means like now I will write or now I will read, in a new way, or now I just have a new way to allow myself to be myself. Like, there's just no award that can match that.
Now, with all the racist violence that's happening recently in America, I mean, things are crazy. Things are crazy. It's
Yes.
amazing for me to, I mean, I live in Karachi. I think they're crazy. That's really, an extreme end of things. But I can't help but feel that there will be an artistic reaction to this as well. That maybe we'll see more and more people of color in creative art coming from the US, whether it's books or movies or musics or murals, whatever it is, because the US is such a large market for these things to the rest of the world.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm really inspired by people, by artists right now that are taking up the mantle of being loud and outrageous about stuff, about the world. Stuff is such a weird word. About what you just said, about the violence, about the racism, and about the way that institutions in the United States give certain forms of violence a pass, which is well documented, and the way that white life is, the society values white life above black life again and again, even when that's the white life of a killer. I think that people are being loud in this generation in a way that we haven't been for ever, maybe. And I mean that in the sense of the young people and artists are both really stepping up to the plate in a lot of ways. And just saying what needs to be said. and being angry and being raw about their anger and their sorrow and all these different things. And I take a lot of inspiration from that. I'm really, really honored to be part of a generation that is loud and that is political and that is unapologetic, you know, in who we are. And having said that, I also feel like it would be great for young adult fiction and speculative fiction to step up a little more, because right now we're seeing a lot of musicians and hip hop artists and R&B folks and just like really, you know, a lot of music people being loud and not a lot of novelists really speaking up. There are some in YA, but at this juncture of history, I feel like it's really on the industry to say, like, not just to kind of try to run this middle line and say all lives matter, or you know, all that bullshit that people do to kind of like teeter totter and be like, yeah, oh yeah, sure, your thing is important too. No, like, this is a moment when you know, this is a continuation of ongoing violent anti-blackness that is global, and people are paying attention in a way that they haven't before, because there's activists throwing themselves in the street and shutting down cities. But it's really on us as artists to like really stand up in this moment and be real about it. And the more that that happens, you know, the more good comes out of it, and the more people are inspired to make more art, and the more people are inspired to live their life fully, and all those things. But YA hasn't spoken to kids of color, you know, historically, directly, very much, except in very segregated, kind of mostly condescending ways, you know, with exception. And it's time to change that. And I think that change is happening. But it's happening because writers of color mainly have taken risks to speak out and demand change. And I think it's worth noting that the diversity conversation, as important as it is still a much easier conversation to have than the Black Lives Matter conversation, as far as the industry is concerned. You know what I mean? Like, it's easy for them to put up a banner that says diversity now that diversity has become a hot button topic, because people, again, fought for that to be an important topic, people of color especially. But I would like to see, you know, publishing houses even be real about taking a stand and saying Black Lives Matter. That's not an easy stand to take, but that's, you know, they're not supposed to be easy. That's why it's not easy to be alive right now. You know what I mean? Like, this is a time to stand up and do something courageous and not just be like, yay, diversity.
What's happening with this graphic novel? What's that about?
It's a little complicated. It's sort of between publishing houses. So I'm actually waiting on word from one to hear about what's going to happen with it. But it's basically it's kind of a reimagined turn of the century Brooklyn. Kind of a steampunk thing, but there's dinosaurs that help out with like infrastructure, and there's like flying machines, and but it's basically about a group of santeros, which are practitioners of Santeria, which is my religion, that hang out in Brooklyn back in the day and try to stop this kind of evil cabal of old men that are trying to let a group of mutants into the world. It's like very sci-fi adventure action fantasy fun type thing, but I really conceived of it as a counter narrative to Lovecraft. So there's a character that is kind of a Lovecraft character, and he's sort of invested in telling stories about them the wrong way, and they're trying to kind of fight back against that counter narrative, and then there's dinosaurs and stuff.
I'm cool with the dinosaurs. In fact, if they build bridges and stuff, you know, please send some my way.
They do. That's exactly what they do. They're building the Brooklyn Bridge with a brontosaurus.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that.
Thank you.
All right, so what's next for you? Midnight Taxi Tango comes out next year, I believe.
Comes out in January. Yeah.
And what's happening after that?
That's a great question. Right in the middle of the third book in the Bone Street Roomba series. So that actually takes place after Salsa Nocturna, which takes place after Midnight Taxi Tango. So that's the order. It goes Half Resurrection Blues, Midnight Taxi Tango, Salsa Nocturna, and then book three. And then, so that I'm really excited about. I'm not quite sure where it's all going. I have some idea, but we'll see. That's also been optioned, so that's exciting too. Anika Noni Rose took about the rights to that, so she's developing something. And what else? I have a book about Cuba that is kind of waiting in the wings to happen. That's also a ghost story, but a much more kind of literary, everyday life type of story. Less like running around, you know, stopping bad guys, more about delving into family history and political history and Cuban history. So that's exciting. And then I'm always teaching and doing workshops and you know, working with other writers, and then I'm always working on essays, even though they sort of drive me nuts, but I also love them. I have a complicated relationship to nonfiction, but it's
I
always
know
there,
what you mean. Know? Yeah, I know what you mean. That's the only kind I write, and I hate it. And every time I have to sit down and write a review, I think, why am I doing this again? You know, but
I honestly do it partly because like an idea for an essay usually shows up very violently in my mind, and I have to write it, or at least put it down in some kind of note form. Otherwise, it just irritates me. I also find that it gets me out there a lot more than fiction does. So people, you know, if I put something up on Salon or BuzzFeed, that get it, they have a reach that I could never get with fiction in general,
right.
For whatever reason. So it does put me out there, and it tends to put me out there in the right kind of way, in the sense that I do write, you know, very clearly political books in a way, even though the focus is on the story. And I use the essays to really outline a lot of the analysis and the framework behind the fiction. So it does, they all kind of tie into each other. And I think that serves me well. But writing them is like such a process.
All right. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I hope we will have you back soon when the next book is out.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.